I will work day in and day out. Wake up and smell the coffee.
The independence case is a powerful one.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order. Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Ben Donat, Editor-in-Chief of Frontier Myanmar. Welcome to the podcast, Ben.
Hey, Will. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you on. Now, the first question that I'd like to ask you is, in terms of the politics of Myanmar, it's obviously something that people in the UK and the West might not be entirely familiar with. Could you give us a general summary of the political situation in Myanmar at the moment?
Sure. I mean, I think a potted history might be useful here. That is to say, you know, Burma was colonized by Britain since from the 19th century until the middle of the 20th century. And then on getting independence in 1948, it enjoyed a brief period of multi-party democracy lasting about 12 years. And then there was a military coup in 1962. And that ever since then, the country's been under various forms of military rule. There was a reform process launched in 2011 that generated a lot of excitement about the country. You know, you had competitive elections that were won by Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy, in 2015. A lot of new freedoms were granted to the populations. You had newfound press freedoms and freedoms for civil society and so on. And many of these changes were, they delivered freedoms that had not been seen since 1962 and, you know, did represent an overwhelmingly positive change. However, what was instituted was a form of power sharing between the military and an elected government. This generated certain tensions because the military, when it decided to open up and reform, it seemed to think that its proxy party, the USDP, would win. It's always had a rather distorted idea about how it was used by the population. They thought that the people would credit it for the very limited development that they had brought to the country, and then the new freedoms that they had introduced from 2011. However, Aung San Suu Kyi's party kept on winning elections, and that party was also trying to change the constitution to reduce the military's role in politics further. Now, after the 2015 election that was resoundingly won by Aung San Suu Kyi's party, I think the military had a sense that perhaps the public would become disenchanted with her and her party. However, the ministry was proved very wrong in that in another election in 2020, Aung San Suu Kyi's party won by an even larger margin, and the military party did even worse. That was a big humiliation for the military, and they decided that enough was enough, and so they then seized power on the 1st of February 2021. And ever since then, you know, the country's been back under full military rule, but there's been a huge swell of resistance to military rule that started in street protests in which millions of people were involved. And when the military cracked down very violently on those, they basically succeeded in creating a new war, as many peaceful protesters decided to take up arms. They headed to the mountainous border areas. They linked up with well-established rebel groups. They learned how to fight and then decided to take the fight to the military. So now what you have is what seems like a fairly entrenched civil war, and that is costing a lot of lives, is not really prompting any real political concessions from the military, and both sides are digging in.
And you mentioned, of course, Aung San Suu Kyi there. In terms of her recognition to the West, she was seen very much, at least initially, as a figure of change in Burma, in Myanmar. Do you think that the Western perception of her was that she would be this figure that would completely revolutionise the country, ensure that democracy stayed a factor in Myanmar, without taking into account the power of the military and also the military's fear that their power could be eroded? Do you think that often in terms of the press reception to her and the press presentation of her, there was a lack of understanding as to that the military could at any moment, as of course they did, intervene and ensure that she didn't have any power at all?
That's a good question. I mean, she was a lauded opposition figure for a long time. You know, she was a Nelson Mandela figure. And so I think a lot of her appeal in the West was the fact that she was, you know, facing overwhelming odds, you know, was keeping the flame of democracy alive. So there wasn't necessarily an expectation that, you know, she would achieve her mission soon or in the near future, really, at any point. You know, it was always, there was this sort of vague idea that, you know, she would prevail one day and Myanmar would become a democracy. And I'd say overall, the world was very pessimistic about the prospects for democracy in the country up until about 10 years ago, when a lot of the reforms that the military introduced went further than expected. And, you know, and then there was a competitive election. And I think then the narrative did a bit of a 180, in that then there were inflated expectations about what the political transition would deliver. And I think it was often slightly obscured that what had been introduced was not full democracy, but a power-sharing agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And Aung San Suu Kyi was essentially navigating a space in which, you know, she'd tried to more straightforwardly oppose the military for a couple of decades, and then, you know, was basically allowed to participate in a sort of mixed system where the best she could really achieve was a form of power sharing. And so she came to accept those parameters and seemingly came to think that, you know, gradually the military may come to accept more change, and that, you know, that if she worked with them, build trust in certain areas, then, you know, they would agree to further changes in the constitution. But I think a lot of that hinged on, you know, that relationship between her and the military, and particularly mm-hmm. between her and the military chief, Min Aung Hlaing, at a personal level. And I think some of the naive assumptions were that, you know, this sort of mixed form of governments, even though it was short of full democracy, could endure for quite some time, was relatively stable, was not ideal, but had delivered new freedoms. That was, you know, that could endure for a while, and the country, the economy could continue to grow, the country could develop. And I think what was underappreciated was how fragile, like, that was, you know, that it was built on this relationship between Aung San Suu Kyi and the military, that, you know, that was incredibly fragile and contingent on certain personalities, you know, that had considered each other enemies for a long time. And that really, as, you know, at the flip of a switch, the military could decide to tear up this deal that they basically formed with civilian politicians, and that, you know, all the positive change could go into reverse very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. One of the other potential flashpoints, indeed it is a great flashpoint in Myanmar, that isn't directly related to the political settlement, is that of Chin nationalism. Now, in terms of Chin nationalism, how far do you think the military will go in, as they see it, combating the Chin people's fight for the greater sovereignty and greater power for themselves? Do you think that we're going to see even further bloodshed on this front? And how aware do you think people outside of Myanmar are as to Chin nationalism, a desire by the Chin people for greater powers and even independence from the rest of Myanmar?
That you highlighted the case of the Chin. The Chin are one of the, I think, minorities of Myanmar. It is a very ethnically diverse country, and several different minority groups have waged rebellions against the central government for many, many decades. You know, these kind of conflicts precede the coup by a long way. But I think the Chin, who occupy a mountainous tract on the border with India in the northwest of the country, had launched a small-scale insurgency, you know, starting in the 1990s, that didn't go as far as in insurgencies in other ethnic minority areas of the country. And since the coup, Chin State, rather surprisingly, has emerged as one of the major centers of armed revolt. You know, within months of the coup, you had newly formed Chin armed groups that, you know, were attacking military bases, you know, scoring all sorts of successes, you know, were then met by a brutal military response that didn't crush opposition there. So this is sort of within the broader context of the armed resistance to the military coup, but it has a certain ethnic dimension in that, like, a lot of these groups are also now advocating for more autonomy for the Chin people within a new federal structure. So the idea is that even, you know, from the Bamar majority, you know, which makes up about 70% of the country, you know, concentrated in the center of the country, it's where the military is almost overwhelmingly drawn from. Aung San Suu Kyi is also drawn from this minority groups. Most of the mainstream politicians are, and that, you know, even within the ethnic mainstream, in opposition to the coup, there is the idea of creating a federal that after, you know, the military junta is defeated and civilian rule is established, one of the most important things they would do is to federalize the country and grant more autonomy to ethnic groups, including the Chin. So therefore, although what the Chin doing might look from the outside a bit like a separatist movement, it's sort of very much part and parcel of the broader national resistance to the military coup, because there's an idea that, you know, ethnic groups could win from this, because there is a broad consensus among the resistance alliance, the alliance of groups that are resisting the coup, that there would be a federal country, that ethnic minorities would get more rights. So I think the military is kind of responding to uprisings in Chin in much the way that it's responding to uprisings in other parts of the country. You know, it's being met with brute force, but so are many other countries, you know, including areas where the ethnic majority reside too. So I think in that sense, in terms of the conflict, it's sort of it can't really be removed from the post-coup political crisis. Although the military is responding to the Chin uprising, you know, through airstrikes targeting civilians and so on, it is also doing that in many other parts of the country, including in the central dry zone, where there's also been, you know, at least in the northwestern parts of the dry zone, huge resistance that's also been met by a very brutal response.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Another group that has suffered a great deal of persecution, particularly in relation to their religion, have been the Rohingya Muslims. And of course, a lot of Rohingya Muslims have had to flee from Myanmar to neighbouring countries. What impact has that had on Bangladesh and India? And do you think that there is more that perhaps the West could do in aiding these refugees? Do you think that there is a willingness from the international community to do more, but there simply has not been a concerted effort by one country to take the lead on it? Do you think that we're going to see any international aid going further than perhaps it is at the moment?
There is a lot of international aid going to the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. I mean, perhaps not as much as is actually needed, because the needs are huge there. You know, it's a population of at least 1 million refugees, you know, living in this, you know, rather narrow tract of Bangladesh. But overall, the Rohingya crisis is rather separate from the post-coup crisis. Post-coup crisis absolutely affects the Rohingya crisis in the sense that, you know, there was a vicious campaign against the Rohingya that, you know, started in a small way with Rohingya militant attacks that were met with brutal reprisals in 2016, and then on a larger scale the following year. And it was that year that you saw hundreds and thousands of Rohingya people being driven from their homes, you know, by the military campaign, and then fled across the border to Bangladesh. And since then, there has been this, you know, multilateral process by which, miraculously to say, a bilateral process between Bangladesh and Myanmar, you know, but with a lot of international support, and where Myanmar has basically agreed to accept back the Rohingya who fled during that time. But the problem is that Rohingya is still a very persecuted group in the country. They are denied full citizenship, or there are all sorts of obstacles that are put in their way, because citizenship is defined in Myanmar along ethnic lines. If you're not considered an indigenous group, then it's very hard to become a citizen, and Rohingya are not considered a native group. And those Rohingya who remain in Myanmar, you know, have their freedom of movement really confined, don't enjoy many of the other basic rights of that citizens should have. So even before the coup, the conditions were not really conducive to the Rohingya returning, because they would be returning to a situation of persecution. However, the military coup has made this even worse, because, you know, like, now the country is ruled by a brutal military regime, and it's also directly ruled by the same military that drove them out of the country in a vicious campaign. So, you know, you basically be returning them to the hands of their torturers. The prospects for Rohingya returning to Myanmar are very bleak. You know, it seems that many of them are condemned to remain in Bangladesh for a very long time. Many of them, you know, in often very poor conditions, you know, where they can't, where the kids struggle to access education or any life opportunities. So many of them are paying people smugglers to flee to Malaysia, you know, often in these rickety boats that sink very frequently. So really, although it's a slightly separate crisis, the post-coup crisis, the Rohingya crisis, I think it has made the prospects for the Rohingya even more bleak. Unless the revolutionary movement against the junta were to succeed in the near future, in which case, you know, the prospects of the Rohingya coup would potentially be turned around, in that what's important to say is that the movement opposing military rule has made certain commitments to respect the rights of the Rohingya, to grant them citizenship, which, you know, represented a bit of a sea change in democratic politics following the coup, in that the problem was before the coup, in that mainstream Myanmar society was not sympathetic to the Rohingya. There was a lot of racism against them. But since then, you know, the National Unity Government, you know, which is a parallel administration, you know, formed to oppose the military junta, has, you know, made a declaration that, you know, it would restore citizenship rights to the Rohingya. So you could say that, you know, their fate in some way dependent on the success of the revolutionary movement, you know, which has made certain pledges to restore their rights and therefore to actually facilitate their successful resettlement back in Myanmar.
Mm-hmm. Now, COVID, of course, was a crisis that affected the entire world, but it had a particularly savage impact on Myanmar, didn't it? In terms of looking now, as a lot of the world is not in the same position that it was during the height of the pandemic, what after effects has there been in Myanmar as a result of COVID? Is it still a threat for people in Myanmar? What's the situation at the moment?
Prior to the military coup, you know, which was just in 1st February 2021, Myanmar had not had a particularly bad time of COVID. You know, it had got through the pandemic relatively unscathed. You know, there was something of an outbreak in 2020 that was late 2020 that was fairly limited in retrospect. However, the coup and the return to military rule basically put Myanmar in the worst possible position for the Delta wave of COVID-19 that had already ravaged India in, you know, the springtime of 2021. And, you know, a month or two after that, it then put Myanmar, you know, a much more virulent strain of the coronavirus. And that inflicted a tragic amount of damage in the country. There was an extraordinary death toll that, you know, was hugely underreported by the military junta. You know, just speaking anecdotally to people or anyone who had any connection to Myanmar, you know, would have known would have had some idea of the toll that it took. You know, friends and colleagues of mine, for instance, you know, many of their older or even not so old relatives died at that time. I think it was particularly bad there because, you know, the coup had eviscerated already a very threadbare and fragile healthcare sector that had just about been able to address the previous outbreaks of COVID, you know, for the Delta wave. And this wave just completely overwhelmed it because, you know, there was already widespread conflict. You know, society was in revolt, but also many medical professionals, they went on strike. They didn't want to work for the military regime. One of the strongest responses to the coup was the civil disobedience movement, which was a strike of government workers who decided to walk out of their offices after the coup in an attempt to kind of bring down the military regime because, you know, it wouldn't be able to function. And this general strike was particularly strong in the health and education sectors. So a lot of the doctors, you know, who did staff the government hospitals before, you know, were simply not there anymore, but were nonetheless trying to provide healthcare and care for COVID-affected people on an individual basis, you know, on like a charitable basis. However, they were being persecuted and hunted down by the military regime for going on strike. So often their efforts to, you know, provide charitable health services to people were stamped down on by the military. And, you know, the military also tried to reserve supplies of oxygen for the state healthcare system. And many people wanted to avoid a boycott, and that, you know, had been rendered very dysfunctional by the civil disobedience movement, and you know, was not really prepared to allow the more private charitable response to fill the gap, you know. So
yeah,
the junta's kind of obsession with trying to impose control like hugely worsened the severity of the outbreak and caused, possibly, you know, I can't put a number on it, but, you know, many unnecessary deaths.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We're coming towards the end of the podcast, Ben. It's been great to talk to you, but I have one final question. In terms of Myanmar's future, obviously there is the military control at the moment. In terms of democracy, things don't look great as it is at the moment. But what are your thoughts about Myanmar's future? Do you have any positive feelings as to change that might happen and to when it might happen? Do you think that it's going to be more of a long-term project, a transition potentially back to some kind of democratic norm? Or do you think that something might happen in the more immediate future?
I think what we have now is the beginnings of what could be quite an entrenched conflict. Mm-hmm. I think early on after the coup, with the massive protests and the civil disobedience movement, there was a lot of hope that, you know, if everyone just came together, that the crisis could be resolved very quickly, and that there could be a regime change, you know, that the revolution could prevail. But mm-hmm. 2 years on, I think there's an acknowledgement that, you know, this is not a crisis that's going to be resolved quickly. You know, although the military is on the back foot, you know, it is facing opposition and armed opposition in, you know, to an unprecedented degree, and offer, you know, and over a huge swathe of the country, and is under huge pressure. The military is incredibly obstinate. You know, it's not going to back down. It's, you know, showing no signs of making any concession. It's just digging in further. So the moment it looks at a point that's sort of nothing short of total defeat would actually bring the military to the table at all. And I think there's still a very strong determination among, you know, the resistance movement to defeat the military decisively. You know, any talk of negotiations are taboo at the moment. So, you know, there is essentially all to play for. Nothing is set in stone in terms of Myanmar's future. However, I think defeating the military is very tall order. You know, it's it is a large military. It has, you know, access to heavy weapons and an air force that can mount aerial raids. The opposition movement, although it is an armed movement, there is it suffers from a chronic under supply of weaponries. A chronic under supply of weaponry. It has no meaningful international support at all. You know, so the resistance moving fighting huge odds, and it seems the military doesn't necessarily care how long the war drags on for, as long as it, you know, gets to be in charge, at least in the capital city. You know, it may cling on to the last. So I think mm-hmm. you're looking at very possibly a very long and grueling conflict, but one I think in which the outcome is foregone in any sense of the word.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you once again for taking the time to record the podcast with me, Ben. If people want to find out more about Frontier Myanmar and more about you, where should they go to find out more about both of you?
Well, you can visit our website at frontiermyanmar.net. There are other convening organizations as well, like Myanmar Now and the Irrawaddy. I would encourage everyone to pay attention to Myanmar. I think there's been an assumption that because, you know, it's getting very little news attention, that nothing has happened, that not much is happening there, or things are dying down. I mean, it couldn't really be further from the case. And, it's going through a lot right now. And I think any form of international support and solidarity would be greatly appreciated by the people of Myanmar, who I think at the moment feel that they've been abandoned by the world. They see the amount of international support and attention going to Ukraine. And although, you know, many of them would be sympathetic to Ukraine, you know, that's a galling thing, you know, to sort of see, oh, you know, we're just a small country that, you know, few people outside of our borders really care about, you know, although, you know, although they've suffered an enormous, a huge injustice at the hand of the military. So I think, you know, statements of support and solidarity, but I think more, you know, material forms of support, I think would be hugely appreciated and currently rather lacking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And I hope that many of the people listening to this will take your advice and do something proactive. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.